Let's go back for our second message to Ecclesiastes chapter 6, Ecclesiastes 6, and today we'll be finishing up this chapter, Ecclesiastes chapter 6. And where we had ended last week was at verse 9, Ecclesiastes 6, 9, which says, "Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind." And you might remember I pointed out that this is the last time in Ecclesiastes that that expression, vanity and striving after wind, both those ideas together, that's the last time that it occurs in the book of Ecclesiastes. And that is important because up to this point in the book, that phrase had been used as a kind of a refrain that summarized in a few words really the thrust of those first six chapters. And so we come to it here, and it marks the end of that first section to where we're expecting that the material going forward is going to have a little bit different focus. We're going to see the word vanity or vapor by itself show up again, so that's going to keep coming along, and that's going to keep before us all of these issues about earthly life. But that phrase stops here, and we actually are in a little bit different emphasis. Yeah, you might recall I've made this distinction that the first six chapters are largely philosophical. They're largely philosophical as Solomon is working to prove that earthly life cannot satisfy the longings of the human heart. And ultimately, those chapters are working together to push us toward our Creator God as the only one who can bring that satisfaction. And it's not that those ideas are left behind as we come to the second half of the book, but what we are going to find is that these chapters tend to be more practical than they are philosophical. Having laid out, having exposed the nature of earthly life in the first six chapters, now Solomon is primarily helping us to figure out, all right, how do I make my way through this world? I need direction to know how to navigate the different areas of life, the different choices of life, given all of its problems, given its nature, given the struggles that I face, keeping it in its place, making a wise use of the opportunities before me in a God-centered way. How do I go about doing that? Ecclesiastes, the second half, is going to be more oriented that way. And just like the first half had a key phrase, there is a key phrase or similar phrases that keep repeating in the second half that are driving home kind of the big idea of those chapters and also serving to divide it up into smaller little chunks. Let me show you what that phrase is that we're going to find many times. You can jump ahead for a moment to chapter 7 and verse 14. And at the end of it, it says, "So that man may not find out anything that will be after him." May not find out anything. Look ahead at chapter 8, verse 17, where again Solomon is talking about the works of God, and he makes the comment that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find out. And as well, chapter 9 and verse 12, "For man does not know his time, like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them." And it used the expression at the beginning, "Man does not know his time." And just one more at chapter 11 and verse 2. Here's a word of advice. It says, "Give a portion to seven or even to eight." Why? "For you know not what disaster may happen on earth." Those kinds of phrases, man can't find out, man does not know, you're not going to be able to know, are highlighting the idea of our ignorance, that we are in the dark about so many things regarding life on earth, That idea really serves to bind together these second six chapters. And yet the point isn't just to convince us of how dumb we are. The older you get, the less you need people to convince you of that. You didn't really need the Bible to tell you that you are ignorant of so many things. Remember that the context of those six chapters is to give you instruction that you might understand how to make good use of life. And the idea is that if you are convinced thoroughly of your ignorance, what it's going to do to you is that it's going to make you willing to follow the wisdom that these chapters are presenting to you. In other words, they are designed, all of this about our ignorance, all of those statements are designed to foster in us a radical dependence on God for guidance in life. To reinforce that we are desperately in need of God to show us how to live because of the fact that we are so ignorant. That's going to be a concept that's going to run all through these passages. And that focus on admitting our ignorance, admitting our limitations, accepting our limitations, and living in the light of those limitations, that's going to be prominent in what is our text today, going back to chapter 6, and it's verses 10 to 12, the last three verses of chapter 6. And I'm taking a little bit more time with this passage. These are fewer verses than we have been looking at before, because that little passage is actually a hinge between the two sections of the book. And it's going to introduce some of these themes that are going to be expanded throughout chapters 7 to 12. And as we get into that, let me share with you a little scenario. Maybe you've heard something like this before. This is a U.S. Navy radio communication. Voice one on the radio. Please divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision. Voice two, recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. Voice one comes back and says, this is the captain of a U.S. Navy ship. I say again, divert your course. Voice two comes back, no. I say again, divert your course. Voice one, this is the aircraft carrier Enterprise. We are a large warship of the U.S. Navy. Divert your course now. Voice two, this is a lighthouse. Your call. Well, Ian Proven, who shared that story, went on to say this as it relates to Ecclesiastes. It is one of the great delusions of our time, and of some earlier, more ancient times as well, that the exertion of human power can shape or can change the shape of reality. That ship was going to be able to do nothing for all the screaming and getting worked up to change the actual situation. And yet we think we can change the shape of reality. The fact of the matter, however, is that reality is a solid rock with a lighthouse sitting upon it, and we can either alter our course to take account of it or keep on going until it imposes itself on us with force. We can insist all we like, with increasingly strident and authoritative words, that reality should be different, but all the words in the world will not make it so. The reality is this: God has created human beings in his image to love and honor him, to love and respect their neighbors, and to look after the planet on his behalf. That is how the universe is. And all who refuse to accept this in the short term will sooner or later have to come to terms with that truth. Well, keep that in mind. I think you will see that that is, in fact, the point of chapter 6, verses 10 to 12. Let me read our text. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives, the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? And maybe you picked up that there is a key word in that little passage as well. It's the word man. It is repeated four times in three verses. And what this text is doing is that it is making several affirmations about the condition of man, about what's going on with humanity, and it is urging us to wise up and to live in the light of those truths regarding ourselves. You know, life can already be hard enough. It will be really miserable if you and I try to live as though we are superhuman and don't accept the limitations that this passage speaks of. There really is wisdom in admitting who we are with all of our limitations. And so our theme this morning is accepting our human condition. Accepting our human condition, and that condition is summarized here in three elements. Though I'm sure there's more that could be said, there is more that could be said about humanity, but these are the truths about us that are critical in this context and that are preparing us for the rest of Ecclesiastes. And here's the first of those elements of our condition. We see it in verses 10 to 11, and it is that as human beings, we are under divine authority. God is the boss. And the sooner that you and I accept that, and the more we remind ourselves of that, the better, the wiser we will be. As human beings, we are under divine authority. Now, you're not going to find the word God directly mentioned in these verses, but it strikes me that this passage is kind of like the book of Esther. It never mentions his name, but he is all over the place as really the subject that is driving all of this, and he is the one that humanity is positioned under very clearly. As human beings, we are under divine authority. And there is a statement here, first of all, that God rules everything. And it is implicit in what verse 10 says at the beginning, whatever has come to be has already been named. Now, there have been other statements in this book already to the effect that what we're facing, what we encounter, has already happened before. That's true, but that's not really the point of this statement. The point of this statement is tied to the word named. Whatever has come to be has already been named. And that is pulling from a practice, an idea in the ancient Near East that when somebody names someone else or something else, the person who declares the name, the person who imposes the name, that indicates that he is in a position of authority. He is determining what this thing or what this person is going to be called from here on out. It shows that that individual is in charge of the other, that individual has the right to assign the function of that other in the realm, whatever is under discussion there. And that should ring a bell, because this is not the first time that the Bible uses the concept of naming to highlight the sovereignty of God. In fact, this passage here and in other places is alluding back to the creation account in the book of Genesis. And I'm just going to remind us of how that all happened in Genesis chapter 1 and how it was that God created everything simply by speaking it forth, and as a part of the process, he himself is assigning the names to these different elements. And so he says, let there be light. God made up the word light. And then God later separated the light from the darkness, and here it is, God called the light day, and he called the darkness night. God designated the name of that realm as the one who was sovereign over it. And then he makes this expanse in the sky to separate waters from waters, and he gives a name to the expanse. In verse 8, he called the expanse heaven, and that was God's name for it. And then God separates the water under the heavens from the dry land, and he called the dry land earth, and the waters gathered together he called seas. You see how he's going through each realm, not only creating it, but assigning it its name, which speaks of the role that the sovereign God is giving to that particular thing. And he goes on to create vegetation. And he goes on to, in verse 14, divide now the lights in the heavens into celestial bodies for signs and seasons and days and years. And he makes two great lights, and he sets them in the expanse, one the lesser to rule the night, and the stars, you've got the sun as well. God is the one who is assigning these individual elements in their place in creation. Now, somebody says, well, isn't it true that in Genesis chapter 2, when it comes to the animals, Adam is the one who gives the name to the different creatures that are passed before him? And that is true, and that's actually going somewhere theologically as well. But the issue would be, who gave Adam the right to be able to do that? God was the one who paraded the animals in front of him. God was the one who gave him a certain amount of authority to set forth those names. I think it's important to keep in mind that in that process, Adam was not passive. He had a role, because some of the things we're going to be saying here about the sovereignty of God could be taken by some to be a kind of a fatalism where man has no role at all in his life. And it's very evident, even in this whole naming thing, that God did not create man to be a robot. God gave man amazing intellectual and creative abilities and gave him the capacity to choose those names. We call that power of choice the will. And yet, even though we don't want to be fatalistic and somehow wipe out the will of man in this process, again, the question is, who created man? Who called him man in the first place? Who gave him those capacities? Even the function that man is playing is under the choice and the superintendence of God. If man has a capacity for choice, it's because God first chose to make him that way. And this truth in Ecclesiastes is just highlighting this doctrine of the sovereignty of God. Whatever has come to be has already been named. And by the way, those names that God gives, it wasn't just a one-time thing, and it wasn't just a generic thing. Listen to what it says in Isaiah 40, 26. Lift up your eyes on high and see who created these. He who brings out their hosts by number, calling them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. All of those individual stars, evidently God has given to them, God has assigned to them their own names, and he is sovereign over every last one. Now, it is fascinating, as you read on through the book of Genesis, how this idea of the name unfolds. You may remember this from when we studied Genesis some years ago. You've got God naming all these things. He gives man the opportunity to name some of the things in nature. And how does this idea of the name unfold? Well, you read on, and before too long, you're at chapter 11. And here are these people who are banding together, living independently of God, wanting to establish themselves on earth independently of God. And they say, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us do what? Let us make a name for ourselves. We're in charge. Nobody's going to tell us what to do. We get to determine our own destiny. We are the masters of our own fate. We're going to establish ourselves as mighty in the earth. And what happened with that effort? God quickly disrupts their building project. He divides them up in the earth. And that whole effort falls to the ground, partially because they were trying to establish a name for themselves. And yet what is so touching is that you come to the next chapter, and as the Lord is interacting with one guy, Abram, and he gives him a whole bunch of promises, he says to him, I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. In other words, what the people at Babel failed to do because it was themselves trying to establish a name for themselves, Abram actually gets because he was in a position of receiving it from the Lord and of bowing before God's sovereignty and of just refusing to resist the folly of that resistance. Maybe he heard about the Tower of Babel, I don't know. But God said, I'm going to give you a name, and you know, to this day we're still talking about him. God gave him a great name. God can give people such a name, but the point is that he is the one who does that, not we ourselves. And when you and I try to do it, we're going to ultimately fail. It is impossible, ultimately, to resist the sovereignty of God. Man, that's just our position. We are subjects to the Almighty Lord. He rules everything. And this goes on as we continue in verse 10 to see that God determines specifically the nature of man. The general concept of God's sovereignty is now narrowed down to man. In the statement, it is known what man is. It's a very short but very full statement. What is he getting at when he goes from saying, whatever has come to be has already been named and it is known what man is? I think, again, that that is alluding back to the creation account and getting you to think about the name man, where that came from, who came up with it, and what its point was from the beginning. Well, in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7, as we find more detail about creation that focuses on the human race, it says, then the Lord God formed the man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living creature. Maybe you knew this, maybe you didn't, maybe you forgot that the word Adam, in Hebrew Adam, is the same root from which the word translated ground in that verse comes. It talks about how God formed man from the dust of the ground. The word dust focusing on the particles of soil. The word ground, a more general word for dirt or the dirt as a whole. As you think about both of those words coming into play there, the word ground, edama, and now this individual made from the edama is called Adam. In other words, our name, the basic name for human nature, is a constant reminder that you and I are made of dirt. And I believe that's what Solomon wants you to remember when he says, it is known what Adam is. Now somebody says, true, but God also said that man was a very dignified creature because he is made in the image of God. And after all, right there in verse 7 of chapter 2, it says God breathed into his nostrils his own breath to bring him to life. Well, true. In fact, the very first time the word Adam occurs is back in chapter 1 when God says, let us make Adam in our image and after our likeness. So there is an amazing dignity to humanity that we don't want to forget. God destined us for greatness and glory as those who have the ability to image his character. But that does not take away from the other side that Solomon is wanting to emphasize here. He is reminding us of the origins of our material makeup, that we're just a pile of dirt in order to humble us. And he is urging us to go through life thinking of ourselves in those terms. That is not all there is to us, but it is an important component that has a very important role in our overall worldview. Go through life accepting that we came from dirt. Why? Not just to make us feel bad, but to keep us freshly aware of just how beholden we are to God for everything. That apart from the Lord breathing into us and sustaining that breath, what's going to become of us is just dirt. There is a strong place in our anthropology, our understanding of man, for that truth of our dependence on God and of the humility, really, of our origins. Is this not what Paul was getting at when he was preaching to the Athenians in chapter 17 of Acts? And he spoke about how God made all these determinations, kind of taking one angle of what Solomon is saying and developing it some, when he says that God has determined the allotted periods and boundaries of people's dwelling, that this nation is going to live here for this time frame and this one over here for that time frame, and this is how the boundaries are going to change from time to time, and I'm the one who is ordering and arranging all of this. Why? That they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. In other words, the truth of creation and the sovereignty of God that flows from that is designed to cause people to seek the Creator, to put them in their position so that they do not think they themselves created themselves, that they are the Lord of their lives, to move them toward a spirit of humility and submission. So God determines the nature of man as dirt to make that point. And then also here, there's nothing that you and I can do to change that. Man cannot alter his condition or undermine God's sovereignty over him. Look at verse 10. It says, and that he is not able, man is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. And that expression, one stronger than he, seems to be another reference to God. And it makes the point that it is foolish to try to argue with God about your basic nature, especially, or make of yourself something more than he has created you to be. He is the one who made these determinations in general about your life and also specifically about each one of us. We are not able to change that, to argue with him like, you messed up, or you should have done it this way, or this is a better idea. You're just not in a position to do that. In fact, C.S. Lewis said that to argue with God is to argue with the very power that makes it possible to argue at all. And Van Til was getting at the same thing when he talked about human beings arguing against God, particularly denying God's existence. He said that's kind of like a little child trying to slap his dad in the face because he's angry. And yet the only way that he can slap his dad in the face is by getting up on his daddy's lap. In other words, here is the human race trying to deny the existence, the sovereignty of God. And so often they do it on the basis of presuppositions that actually require the existence of God. In other words, they're over here accusing God for, you know, how can God exist when there's evil in the world, there's so much suffering? And the ultimate rebuttal to that is, why should you care that there's evil in the world if there is no God? What makes anything wrong or evil? If there is no standard out there that says this is the way that things have to be. If it's just randomness and there is no order and there is no eternal sovereign mind over this, on what basis can we even determine what is right or wrong, or should it matter that some people are hurting others or that they're suffering? In other words, to argue against God, you have to take God for granted. Man cannot alter that. And he is in no position to argue against the Lord's sovereign rule. And yet we try, and we fill blogs and books and debates with efforts to dispute against God. And here in verse 11 is the bottom line response of the Lord: the more words, the more vapor. And what is the advantage to man? That's the same point as there at the end of verse 10, but he ties it in with the key word vapor. There's no substance to this. He also uses a word related to that key word, profit. There's no profitability to this. It's a waste of time. No matter what arguments you bring up, no matter how heated you become, no matter how intellectual you may be, no matter how eloquent your words may be, you are wasting your time to try to put God underneath the microscope and evaluate him and judge him and tell him he's not doing the right thing, to tell him he really shouldn't be in control. It's just so much hot air. Man cannot alter his condition or undermine God's sovereignty over him. That point is made about the sovereignty of God, but as we move on, we're going to see another factor here of our condition as human beings. You know, as I get into this, I'm reminded so much of the book of Job. Last time you read Job, maybe you had the same feeling that I always have. You could get past about chapter 4, and you just feel like all these guys are just going round and round, saying a lot of the same things and getting nowhere in this discussion. And it just keeps getting more intense as there's more accusations, and Job has more rebuttals, and then he starts to argue against God, and you're like, this is a bunch of hot air. None of these guys know anything of what's really going on. They didn't have chapters 1 and 2. And if you feel like, man, why did God include like 30 chapters of this stuff over and over? It's like, this is just a total bunch of baloney. Why do I have to read this? Okay, I want to encourage you with the fact that God said the same thing about what they were saying, that you have just read a bunch of baloney. He said, chapter 38, verse 1, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? These people don't know what they're talking about. They may have some basic good ideas about God, but as they apply it to this situation, they're clueless. And God says, you have just read 30 chapters of cluelessness. And that was talking especially about Job's own words. But in chapter 42, he says, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Right? He's talking to Eliphaz, one of the friends, kind of the chief one, I guess, about the friends of Job. So Job is being rebuked for his hot air, and now the friends are rebuked as well. If you've ever felt like those lengthy chapters are a bunch of nonsense, God basically says, you're right. That's what he told to the speakers. Now, why are they in the Bible? Anyway, I think partially to make the point that Ecclesiastes is making. Nobody can dispute with God. You fill it up with words, You can say all you want. It's just a bunch of vapor. Don't waste your time like Job and his friends did. I think that's the conclusion you're supposed to come to by being exposed to this more or less worthless conversation. It's teaching you to stop trying to argue with God like that yourself. And that brings us to the next statement here. We have said a lot about being under divine authority as human beings. Now we're going to see, secondly, that as human beings, we do not inherently know how to make the best use of life. We're not only under authority and in no position to tell God what to do, but even as it relates to our own lives, we are clueless about what to do. Just in the nitty-gritties of our own daily decisions, we don't know what is best. And in verse 12, it says, "For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow." And in that statement, the key word is the term good. I think ultimately that would include moral absolutes. Who knows what is good morally, ethically? We know that to some extent those have been written on our consciences, that comes from God. We know as well that often we resist our consciences and suppress that truth. And whether or not we are aware of what is good that God has already shown us, we definitely do not practice them naturally as the habit of our lives. So I think we're justified to include in this statement, we don't know what is good in and of ourselves apart from God, that does include ultimately these kind of moral absolutes. But in the context of Ecclesiastes, the focus is not so much on matters of basic morality, it is on matters of wisdom, of how to apply the principles that God has laid out in his word to specific decisions of life. And Solomon says that is especially important to know what is good because of how short of a time period you have on earth. Notice how he says, "For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow." He uses three different expressions to highlight the brevity of our lives. In fact, literally this says, "The number of the days of life are a vapor, and man makes or spends those days like a shadow." They quickly disappear. It's kind of like when you just have a little bit of money left at the end of the month. The smallness of the money makes you unusually careful about how you spend it. Okay, I remember in college when kids today have scholarships and rich parents and whatever else, but you know, we used to have to pay for our laundry, and that was sometimes a major burden just to have enough money to pay for your laundry. Now you got free laundry. You're very careful. I'm not going to go to the snack shop and buy myself a cheeseburger if I don't know that I have enough to do my laundry at the end of the week. The small amount makes it critical that I manage this well. And this is what he's saying about our time. The days of the life on earth are vapor, and you pass them like a shadow, so you better invest them well. They're slipping away. You can't stop that. You only have so much to work with. And sometimes people will say, if you knew that you only have 24 hours left on earth, how would you use those 24 hours? And what Solomon is saying, really, no matter how much time you have, you need to have that mentality, that it is very short and I don't know when it's going to end. And so it behooves me to align myself to the order of God's world, not to be making choices that are against the way things are fixed by the sovereign order of God, including the fact that God has cursed this world because of sin. And there are all kinds of problems out there that he is aware of. And he has established an order for how to conduct yourself in that kind of world. It takes skill. And Solomon asks, who knows what is good for man in that situation? And the answer that's expected is nobody does. you inherently lack the skill to be able to make a wise use of the little bit of time you have. But he's not saying that just so that we'll be depressed and walk away in despair, like, what am I going to do? All of this, like everything else in the book, it is pushing you to God, right? The implication is that God does know what is good, and so we had best seek him and pay careful attention to what he has laid out for us as the life of wisdom. That is the thrust of what we're going to find in the rest of Ecclesiastes. It's going to sound a lot like Proverbs because it's all about wisdom for the different areas of life. And it is not exhaustive. It's like not going to tell you everything you need to know to be making wise choices, but it is going to put us in a much better position than if we were, as Proverbs says, leaning on our own understanding. In fact, that word good occurs a number of times in the second half of the book, and particularly in chapter 7, which we will be our next text when we come back to this. Look at chapter 7, verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment. And the point is, are you thoroughly persuaded that you don't know what is good? Here's what the first thing God's going to tell you. You know what would be good? For you to pursue a good name. For you to live a life of being so committed to God's ways and so above reproach that it is evident to those around you, this guy is not leaning on his own understanding. There's something unusual about this person. You know what's good in life? A good name is good. A good reputation. You know what else is good in life? Actually, as you go to verse 2, the word good is in there in Hebrew, but it's translated for us, it is better to go to the house of mourning. And we want to say it that way instead of saying it is gooder to go to the house of mourning, though that's really what it says. I'm just making the point that's the same word good. It is more good to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind and the living will lay it to heart. Somebody says, who knows what is good? God does. Okay, what does God say? Here's one thing God says. Spend some time reflecting on your death. You're going to be in a better position to make wise choices if you spend more time thinking about that than parting. That's one thing that would make for a good life. And that's how this unfolds, verse by verse. We're going to see it as we come back to chapter 7. If we are persuaded of our limitations as human beings, we will earnestly seek and practice the wisdom that God is giving us here. But how are we so often? We are like most of us males here, who when they get a new toy for their kids or a new bike or a new piece of equipment, you rip the box open and you just start trying to put it together. And 3 hours later, after you've yelled at your wife and your kids and you're about ready to lose it, the thought strikes you, maybe I should have read the instructions. Okay? That's what Solomon is saying. You don't know the best use of life. Pay attention to what the Lord has laid out in giving you wisdom. And finally, as human beings, we not only don't know how to make the best use of life, but we cannot predict the future. That's the last thought there in verse 12. For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? And that is the next natural thought. I mean, if I don't know enough to make good choices in the present, how in the world can I predict the future? I mean, I got my hands full enough just trying to figure out what's going on right here and doing the right thing. How in the world am I going to be able to say this is what's going to happen in the future? And when it says what will happen after him under the sun, that's focusing on things of earth. And this has come up before already, like in chapter 2, verse 18. Where it spoke about earthly possessions and this problem that you face if you've accumulated all this wealth, you're going to die. That's going to continue. And what's going to happen to it after that? You do not have the ability to predict what's going to happen to it. And the application is, look, you don't go crazy worrying about that. It's going to be out of your control. There's no way you can guarantee the ongoing success of these things. Focus on the present to make whatever good use you can of it for your life and those around you right now, the future is out of your hands. What I want to do, in addition to that, is think of this from the standpoint of eternity and the New Testament. Because if we are beholden to God for anything regarding the future on earth after we die, how much more beholden are we to the Lord regarding the future as it relates to eternity? I think we ought to argue from the lesser to the greater that way. If I can't figure out what will become of the earthly inheritance that I leave behind, how could I possibly figure out by myself anything about my eternal destiny in the future? And here again, when Solomon asked the question, who can tell man what will be after him? The answer is nobody can. No human being is capable of doing that. And again, he is getting us to the Lord to say, if you want to know about that, if you want to have confidence about that, you've got to look to the one who is sovereign over all these things. And here is how we ought to think. The eternal God is the one who created me with an eternal spirit that is going to live somewhere forever. Since my perspective is so time-bound and it is so earth-bound, and I can hardly figure out here on earth what to do sometimes from day to day, the only reliable way that I have to know anything about this other dimension that's going to last forever is God himself. Once again, it is pushing me to him for instruction, for guidance about the ultimate future. And Ecclesiastes isn't really going to get into that, but it is spurring you on to seek God about it and to read the rest of your Bible for instruction about eternity. And here are the kinds of answers you're going to find in other places in the Bible. You're concerned about what's going to happen after you die. Jesus said, "This is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent." You're concerned about the future. You can't figure it out by yourself. Listen to Jesus' words. "In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." He is filling you in about the future. He is giving you material information, teaching you would not otherwise know. He is giving you divine revelation because you could not figure this out by yourself. And earlier in John, he said, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" And that would be the question for all of us today. Do you believe that? Have you recognized your inability to figure out eternity and to get yourself into eternity? And have you cast yourself on the only one who actually knows about that, who can predict the future? He is the resurrection and the life. Well, whether we're talking about the future or the present, here is what this passage is calling us to. It is calling us to a radical distrust in ourselves, and coupled with a radical dependence on God. A radical, do you trust yourself to figure life out? You have no way to guarantee anything about today or tomorrow, or to know what would be the best way to invest your time. A radical distrust in myself and a radical trust in the sovereign God. Read an illustration from an early church father whose name was Didymus the Blind, and he compared our lives to being on a ship. And maybe you've been on a ship, a cruise or something, and it could be you could go through that whole experience without ever meeting the captain. knowing what he looks like or what he's like. And nevertheless, if this is a well-established cruise line that has made these trips many times before, you're not really staying up at night worrying about it. And he said this, when you see a ship which is piloted and holds its course, you perceive the idea of a helmsman, of a captain, even if he is not visible. Likewise, the Creator is known by his works and the order of his providence. In other words, you can't see God. He has never talked to you audibly, personally. But there is more than plenty in his word, in your life experience, to know there's a pilot there. He's invisible, but he is the one who's actually running the show, and he knows a lot more about running ships than I do. And my attitude is going to be not to lean to my own understanding, but just to default to his wisdom and his guidance. This week I was listening to a message, and the preacher said, there are two ways to live your life. You can either trust God, or you can try to be God. You can either trust God, or you can try to be God. And that's not like a choice you make once in your life. I'm going to trust God, and that settles it. That's a daily attitude that has to be renewed. I am not God, and I'm not going to try to be like him. To try to be him in the sense of being the ruler of everything and the ultimate determiner. That spirit of trust has to be renewed, or in fact, we all do default to trying to be like God. And I know the Lord will continue to instruct us about our dependence on him as we make our way through the second half of this wonderful book.